Good day, SunSound listeners. This is Janet Martin. I'll be reading portions of the Arizona Daily Star. It is Wednesday, December 18th, 2025. The University of Arizona projects its research activity exceeded $1 billion in fiscal year 2024, which it says would put the university into a select group of top research institutions. Those include Stanford University, Duke University, Harvard, University of California, Los Angeles, University of Florida, University of Michigan, and the University of North Carolina. Our faculty members tackle urgent global challenges from energy and environmental issues to national security, human health, and societal impact of technological change, said U.S. President Suresh Garmela, who joined the university on October 1st in announcing the research milestone and a news release Tuesday. Among the university's 2024 research highlights noted by the university, retrieving the largest asteroid sample ever brought to Earth, advancing a vaccine for valley fever to human clinical trial, the world's first against fungal infection to reach this stage, and mitigating the efforts of extreme heat. The university will submit its data to the National Science Foundation to review, and the official number is set to be confirmed this fall. This feat in research spending was achieved in the midst of the university's year-long budget deficit and financial crisis revealed by former President Robert C. Robbins in the fall of last year. The university continues to rebuild its faculty and staff numbers after layoffs and a temporary hiring freeze, having reduced its year-end projected budget deficit to $63 million from $177 million. Research is the cornerstone of the University of Arizona's standing as a world-class institution, and our largest ranking reaffirms this excellence, said Tomas Diaz de la Rubia, Senior Vice President of Research and Innovation, in the news release. His role at the University of Arizona started November 11th. The most recent National Science Foundation ranking showed that the University of Arizona spent a total of $955 million on research activity in fiscal year 2023, including more than $356 million in health sciences, which placed the university among the nation's top 20 public research institutions for the sixth year in a row. It ranks among the top 4% of the 900 university and colleges invested in research and development. It has maintained its number one ranking in astronomy and astrophysics since 1987. It also holds the rankings of number two among public universities for space science, number four in high Hispanic enrollment, number six in NASA-funded activity, number seven in physical sciences, number 20 in overall public universities, and number 36 across all universities, according to the university website. The scale of our research enterprise provides the capacity to lead multi-institution and interdisciplinary successes like the Orosis Rex asteroid mission, and to pursue revolutionary advancements that will benefit people everywhere, such as personalized medical treatments with the Center for Advanced Molecular and Immunological Therapies, said Garmela. An Alabama woman is recovering well after a pig kidney transplant last month that freed her from 8 years of dialysis, the latest effort to save human lives with animal organs. Tawana Looney is the fifth American given a gene-edited pig organ, and notably, she isn't as sick as prior recipients who died within 2 months of receiving a kidney or heart. "It's like a new beginning," said Looney, 53. "Right away, the energy I had was amazing. To have a working kidney and to feel it, it's unbelievable." Looney's surgery marks an important step as scientists get ready for formal studies of xenotransplantation, expected to begin next year, said Dr. Robert Montgomery of New York University Lagona Health, who led the highly experimental procedure on November 25th. On Tuesday, NYU announced Looney is recuperating well. She was discharged from the hospital just 11 days after the surgery, although she was temporarily readmitted this week to adjust her medications. Doctors expect her to return home to Gadsden, Alabama in 3 months. If the pig kidney were to fail, she could begin dialysis again. To see hope restored to her and her family is extraordinary, said Dr. Jamie Locke, Looney's original surgeon, who secured U.S. Food and Drug Administration permission for the transplant. President-elect Donald Trump has called on President Joe Biden to halt the sale of unused border wall components originally intended for projects along the U.S.-Mexico border. The materials include steel bollards recently appeared for sale on GovPlanet, a government surplus auction marketplace. I'm asking today Joe Biden to stop selling the wall, Trump said, emphasizing the cost of the materials. He accused Biden of increasing expenses by selling the components as his administration prepares to resume construction. The auction listings have ignited debate online, with many questioning why the materials were sold when Trump campaigned to finish the wall. Representative Eli Crane, a Republican from Arizona, told the Daily Wire, which first reported the auctions, that the Biden administration was purposely hamstringing the incoming Trump presidency. So why are the materials for the construction of more border fence being moved now? The answer is the National Defense Authorization Act, a law passed by Congress in the 2024 fiscal year. Section 2890 of the National Defense Authorization Act, introduced by Republican lawmakers in the House, requires the Department of Defense to develop a plan to use, transfer, or donate all covered materials purchased for the border barrier construction between fiscal years 2017 and 2022. The law mandated that the Department of Defense submit a plan to use, transfer, or donate to states on the southern border of the United States all covered materials within 75 days of the National Defense Authorization Act's enactment and began executing it 100 days later. The process continued until the date on which the Department of Defense is no longer incurring any costs to maintain, store, or protect the covered materials. This led to the eventual sale of a portion of these materials through the GovPlanet, a government surplus marketplace. Congressional leaders unveiled a stopgap spending bill Tuesday that will keep the federal government funded through March 14th and provide more than $100 billion in emergency aid to help states and local communities recover from Hurricanes Helene and Milton and other natural disasters. The measure would prevent a partial government shutdown that would begin after midnight Friday. It would kick final decisions on the budget year's spending levels to a new Republican-led Congress and President-elect Donald Trump. The continuing resolution generally continues current spending levels for agencies. Passage of the measure is one of the final actions that lawmakers will consider this week before adjourning for the holidays and making way for the next Congress. It's a second short-term funding measure the lawmakers took up this fall as they struggled to pass a dozen annual appropriation bills before the new fiscal year began October 1. The bill will provide $100.4 billion in disaster relief with an additional $10 billion in economic assistance for farmers struggling with drought in some regions and floodings in others. We have to be able to help those who are in dire straits, said House Speaker Mike Johnson, told reporters. Net farm income is projected to decline 4.1% this year after falling 19.4% the year before from the record highs reached in 2022. Johnson indicated more farm aid could be delivered to the next Congress, saying, "We can't just do it right now. Congress is doing the best it can under difficult circumstances, and I think it will be a big boost for the industry," Johnson said. NASA announced Tuesday that stuck astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams had their space mission extended again and now won't be back on Earth until spring, 10 months after rocketing into orbit. The State Department carved out loopholes for Israel that gives the close American ally a pass on the 1997 Lehi Law, a U.S. law restricting aid to foreign militaries over human rights abuses. A lawsuit from a group of Palestinians in Gaza and American relatives asserted Tuesday. New York architect Rex Hoerman, facing murder charges in a string of deaths known as the Gilligo Beach killings, pled not guilty Tuesday in the killing of a seventh woman, Valerie Mack, age 24. In a rare joint statement, the archivist and deputy archivist of the United States said Tuesday the 1970s era Equal Rights Amendment cannot be certified without further action by Congress or the courts, as Democrats press President Joe Biden to act unilaterally on its ratification. The motive for a shooting that killed a teacher and student and wounded others at a Wisconsin school appears to be a combination of factors, a police chief said Tuesday, as he appealed to the public to share what they might know about the 15-year-old girl who attacked a study hall before shooting herself. Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes offered no details about a possible motive, though he said bullying at Abundant Life Christian School would be investigated. Barnes said police are also investigating writings that might also have been penned by Natalie Rupnow and could shed light on her actions. Identifying a motive is our top priority, but at this time it appears that the motive is a combination of factors, the chief told reporters. In addition to the deaths, six people were wounded, including two students who remain in critical condition. The shooter died of a self-inflicted gunshot. Barnes said police were talking with the shooter's father and other family members and searching the shooter's home. The shooter's parents, who are divorced, shared joint custody of their child, but the shooter primarily lived with her father, according to court documents. A senior Russian general was killed Tuesday by a bomb hidden in a scooter outside his apartment building in Moscow, a day after Ukraine's security service leveled criminal charges against him. A Ukrainian official said the service carried out the attack. Lieutenant General Igor Krivolov, the chief military's nuclear, biological, and chemical protection forces, was killed as he left for his office. Krivolov's assistant also died. Krivolov, 54, was under sanctions from several countries, including the UK and Canada, for his actions in Moscow's war in Ukraine. On Monday, Ukraine's Security Service, or SBU, opened a criminal investigation against him, accusing him of directing the use of banned chemical weapons. An official with the SBU who spoke on condition of anonymity said the agency was behind the attack. The official described Krivolov as a war criminal and an entirely legitimate target. The SBU says it recorded more than 4,800 occasions where Russia used chemical weapons on the battlefield since its full-scale invasion in February 2022. In May, the U.S. State Department said it recorded the use of chlorpyrifosine, a poison gas first deployed in World War I against Ukrainian troops. At a time of heightened political division, Americans' confidence in their country's judicial system and courts dropped to a record low of 35% this year, according to a new Gallup poll. The United States saw a sharp drop of 24% over the past 4 years, setting the country apart from other wealthy nations where most people on average still express trust in their systems. The result comes after a tumultuous period that included the overturning of the nationwide right to abortion, the indictment of former President Donald Trump and subsequent withdrawal of federal charges, and his attacks on the integrity of the judicial system. The drop wasn't limited to one end of the political spectrum. Confidence dropped among people who disapproved of the country's leadership during Joe Biden's presidency and among those who approved, according to Gallup. The respondents were asked about their party affiliations. It became normal for people who disapprove of the country's leadership to also lose at least some confidence in the court system. Still, the 17-point drop recorded among the group under Biden was precipitous, and the cases filed against Trump were likely factors, Gallup said. Among those who did approve of the country's leadership, there was an 18-point decline between 2023 and 2024, possibly reflecting dissatisfaction with court rulings favoring Trump, Gallup found. Confidence in the judicial system has been above 60% among the group during the first 3 years of Biden's presidency, but but nosedived this year. Trump faced four criminal indictments this year, but only a hush money case in New York ended with a trial and conviction before he ran the presidential race. Since then, special counsel Jack Counsel has ended his two federal cases, which pertain to Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss and allegations that he hoarded classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. A separate state election interference case in Fulton County, Georgia, is largely on hold. Trump denies wrongdoing in all. Other Gallup findings have shown that Democrats' confidence in the Supreme Court dropped by 25 points between 2021 and 2022, the year the justices overturned constitutional protections for abortion. Their trust climbed a bit to 34% in 2023, dropped again to 24% in 2024. The change comes after a Supreme Court opinion that Trump and other presidents have broad immunity from criminal prosecution. Trust in the court among Republicans, by contrast, reached 71% in 2024. The judicial system more broadly also lost public confidence more quickly than many other U.S. institutions over the last 4 years. Confidence in the federal government, for example, also declined to 26%. That was a 20-point drop, not as steep as the decline in the confidence of the courts. Arizona lawmaker targets panhandlers, others, and medians. He says it's only about public safety, but a new proposal by State Senator John Kavanaugh would have the effect of making it illegal for panhandlers to be in street medians. The state law he proposes doesn't actually mention begging, nor does it refer to people who set up in mediums to sell items to passing motorists. Instead, it spells out the individuals that individuals would not be allowed to remain on a traffic medium or island that is less than 10 feet wide unless they expeditiously are crossing the street. People standing on mediums where cars are driving by at 40 to 50 miles an hour is dangerous, said Kavanaugh, a Fountain Hills Republican. It's dangerous for the person on the medium, and it's dangerous for drivers who may have to swerve and get into an accident or perhaps hit him if they step into the roadway if they're intoxicated. The bill does include some exceptions in addition to people expeditiously crossing the street. Pedestrians could also hang out on a medium or island that has constructed paths, sidewalks, bus stops, benches, or similar structures that are designed to accommodate a person's presence. Kavanaugh insisted his Senate Bill 1029 has nothing to do with cutting down on begging. I don't think that's because I banned dangerous panhandling on narrow medians that people will suddenly stop panhandling and get jobs, he said. They're just going to go to the sidewalk, so it's not going to have any effect. But Kavanaugh has a history of writing state laws that do specifically target the practices of those who beg for money for handouts. Those efforts started after a federal judge ruled in 2013 that panhandling is protected by the First Amendment. That voided all Arizona statutes that made the practice illegal. A Tucson man has been arrested on suspicion of first-degree murder after authorities say he shot and killed a man, then set the body ablaze in an effort to retrieve the bullet casing, authorities said. Christopher Compton, 43, was arrested Monday and booked into the Pima County Jail on a $1 million bond on one count of first-degree murder, police say. The Tucson police received an anonymous tip about the killing on Saturday, prompting officers to search an area near East Ponicania Drive and South Almond Street, near South Pantano and East Escalante Roads, where they located a badly burned body, according to an interim complaint filed in the Pima County Justice Court. A single cartridge case was loaded next to the remains. The tipster told police that Compton had gone to a family member's home on December 9th looking for bleach and asking to use his washing machine. He also asked the tipster if a metal detector would locate a brass bullet casing, the complaint says. At some point, the family member said Compton began to cry and confessed to the killing. He said Compton had been threatening him since he confessed, the complaint says. The burned body was found near Compton's home, police said. The body was too burned to make an immediate identification. Compton told police he did not live with the alleged victim, but allowed him to shower at his home. The family member told police Compton said he shot the man with what he thought was a paintball gun during an argument about a stolen battery charger. The Arizona State Board for Charter Schools has greenlit a virtual charter school where a computer program will teach students core instruction for just 2 hours a day. In those 2 hours, students will use artificial intelligence-powered platforms to engage in short, focused bursts of learning across different subjects, according to the charter application. The school, Unbound Academy, will serve 4th through 8th graders. The school's founders in their application said the 2-hour AI-powered model can condense the time students spend learning by personalizing instruction and removing inefficiencies that exist in traditional classrooms. An AI tutor gives each student individualized learning plans and ensures they master each concept before moving on, they said. When you're getting one-on-one personalized learning, it doesn't take all day, said co-founder Mackenzie Price. Having a personal tutor is absolutely the best way for a student to learn. Unfortunately, that has not been possible in our traditional educational system. After 2 hours of academics in the morning, students will spend the rest of the day pursuing personal interests and participating in life skill workshops, which could include topics like storytelling, public speaking, financial literacy, and teamwork, she said. Instead of traditional classroom teachers, the school will employ guides who won't teach students academics, but will instead provide them with motivation and emotional support, Price said. A teacher won't help a student figure out how to carry the one when they are learning how to add, for example, but instead will point them to the right video explanation, she said. The charter board approved the application for Unbound Academy on Monday, despite hesitation from the board review panel that assessed the approval. The school will use a 2-hour learning model developed by Price, who debuted it at a private school she co-founded in Austin, Texas, called Alpha School, where tuition is $40,000 annually. After explaining the model to additional private schools in Texas and Florida, the founder looked to bring it to Arizona as a publicly funded but privately operated charter school. Arizona was an appealing place to expand the model because it has been a very friendly state for school choice, Price said. Arizona has been one of the states that really has been leading the charge on alternative methods of education, she said. The charter board's review panel thought the model for Unbound Academy was unique and innovative, according to its report. The report pointed to the testing success the founders' Texas private school have seen, noting that most students at both ends of the spectrum, excelling students and struggling ones, made more than a year's growth in core academic content areas as shown by state and national assessments. The review panel was concerned, however, that a curriculum for the Arizona Charter School had not yet been chosen, writing its report that it was challenging to understand what the students would learn at each grade level because the application lacked sufficient detail. The panel also thought the plan to use AI technology as a teacher might be challenging to sell to parents, and it was concerned about the fact that when students struggled, guides would simply serve to find and load additional virtual lessons for them rather than evaluate the error and provide high-quality instruction to the students themselves. During an interview with the review panel, Unbound Academy representative Andrew Price said the school's founders recognize that Arizona has a lot of online options, and many of them are operating under their capacity. However, he said he thought there would be a demand for Unbound Academy. He noted that Mackenzie Price had about 500,000 social media followers, and founders estimated at least 10,000 were parents in Arizona. When asked by the review panel about the vision for the first year of the school, Andrew Price said he wanted to get a couple hundred kids in the school and show we can meaningfully improve outcomes. During the 2 hours of daily instruction time, Mackenzie said, students would learn via educational apps like iX Math and AI Tutor, would monitor their progress and personalize their instruction. The AI rigorously analyzes comprehensive student data, response accuracy, engagement duration, and emotional feedback via webcam to ensure lessons are appropriately challenging, the charter application stated. The Arizona Department of Education this fall purchased thousands of licenses for public school students to use Khan Academy's AI tutoring chat box, Kamigo. Both Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn and Khan Academy founder Sal Khan told the Arizona Republic that they did not think the AI tutor would replace teachers, but would instead make their lives easier. Leanne Lindsay, the Director of EdTech and Innovation for the Arizona Institute of Education and Economy at Northern State University, which this spring released AI guidance for K-12 schools in the state, said she saw positive elements in the Unbound Academy model, but she wasn't sure if the AI technology was ready for such a venture. Charter schools are positioned to provide some out-of-the-box atypical instruction, she said, specifically when it comes to AI. I think now is the time to take some calculated risks, she said. She liked the school's goal of maximizing instructional time with AI to create room for other interactions and learning opportunities. While it's time to innovate, Lindsay said, this is a really big risk. There is not yet research out there saying that content of all subject areas should be taught in this way, Lindsay said, so we don't know how effective this is going to be. AI models are susceptible to misinformation and bias, which could be problematic if the school did not provide mitigating human oversight, she said. Students need human connection, Lindsay said. If the technology provides space for more human connection, then that's amazing. But we should never allow technology to push humanness out of teaching, she said. Mackenzie Price said the Unbound Academy is not a ChatGPT teach my child kind of school. The AI tutors manage students' progress through apps that are all based on curriculum, she said. On Monday, the Charter Board approved the school to open in fall 2025 to 200 students. The school's founders had proposed launching with 250 kids, but the board lowered the enrollment number cap because some board members said Arizona's virtual school market is saturated. From time to time, I'm suspect of online learning in an environment where the state's pain, said board member Jan Swanson after voting in favor of the application. I would love to have you guys voluntarily come back and present after you have a year under your belt, please. I think that using AI in education, you have to break the model and move forward and do something. So good luck. I'm excited. Go for it. Paul McCartney was on Arizona State's University Tempe campus in November, mixing it up with Sparky, the ASU mascot, and throwing a pitchfork sign in photos. The pics were taken at a ceremony for Nancy Chevelle McCartney, his wife of 13 years, who was inducted into the W.P. Carey Alumni Hall of Fame. The former Beatle was mingling with faculty and staff, taking selfies with students, even throwing a pitchfork for the camera, according to an ASU News report. In her remarks at the W.P. Carey ceremony in November, Chevelle McCartney recalled being the only woman who graduated with a degree in transportation from the business school in 1981. And now, the supply chain major within the W.P. Carey School business is wide open with career opportunities for women, she said, according to ASU News. In the On Nutrition article, Day P. from Tucson writes, I read that in order to derive the full nutritional value from mushrooms, they should be nuked in the microwave for 2 to 3 minutes. Is that true? And are there other vegetables that should be cooked in that way? She answers, you may be referring to a 2022 study published in the journal Foods that compared different cooking methods on the retention of helpful substances in mushrooms. These researchers reported that microwaving for 3 minutes was the best method to retain their strong antioxidant activity. Mushrooms' flavor, however, was best enhanced with pressure cooking and stir frying. Steaming or microwave cooking are generally the top methods recommended to preserve nutrients in vegetables. I personally like to roast vegetables in the oven. Lo and behold, roasting actually helps make nutrients in those foods more digestible, according to a 2021 review in Food Chemistry. And I would argue that nothing compares to the yummy flavor imparted to vegetables cooked that way. On the opinion page, there is a Christmas garland, and on the middle of it as a decoration is the head of the DOJ Merrick Garland. Garland, a mostly decorative wreath hung on an inanimate object. Zakari writes, Russia is weaker than you think, and Trump knows it. The collapse of the Assad regime in Syria should be a reminder of a general truth that often gets obscured in the blizzard of conflicting news stories that absorb us day to day. The West's adversaries are often weaker than we think. Recall how for decades the United States overestimated the strength of the Soviet economy and armed forces. The surety with which it claimed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and the frequent scares around Islamic militant groups such as Al-Qaeda and more recently Hezbollah. Yet, over time, what becomes apparent is that these governments and groups are repressive, corrupt, and dysfunctional, not attributes that help them thrive in the modern world. Bashar al-Assad's fall points to a direct lesson, Russia's growing weakness. Moscow has been Syria's patron for over half a century. Syria was Russia's last major client state in the Middle East. Moscow had spent huge amounts of blood and treasure supporting Assad over the past decade. To lose that position is to become what Barack Obama dismissively called Russia, a regional power. Even in Russia's own region, relations have deteriorated with Armenia, a longtime ally that Russia failed to defend from Azerbaijan's aggression because it was bogged down in Ukraine. Russian forces in Africa also are increasingly facing pressure from a variety of militant groups. Vladimir Putin's Russia now resembles the Soviet Union in the 1970s. While still assertive and interventionist abroad, its economy at home is increasingly weak and distorted by its conversion into a wartime operation. But just as the external expansion and internal mobilization could not mask Soviet decay forever, so today Putin's bravado should not scare us. Think about it. If Russia were winning Ukraine, would Putin threaten to use nuclear weapons? Two scholars, Mark DeVore and Alex Mertens, note in Foreign Policy that Russia is losing around 320 tank and artillery cannon barrels a month and producing only 20. Citing open sources, they note that Russia has lost almost 5,000 infantry fighting vehicles since its 2022 full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Russia's defense contractors can make only around 200 a year. Its labor shortages are acute in virtually every sector, something even Putin has acknowledged. In the military, the starkest signs is that the Russian army has had to invite North Korea to send its troops to help out. Noel Foster of the Naval War College wrote that Moscow's desperation can be seen in rising salaries and bonuses it has to offer to recruits. As of July 2024, recruits from Moscow received a $21,000 enlistment bonus and wages amounting in total to just under $60,000 in their first year service, effectively earning more per month than private enlisting in the U.S. Army at the same time. Keep in mind that average Russian income is less than one-fifth that of Americans. All these weaknesses are obscured for now by a massive wartime transformation of the Russian economy. Defense spending is projected to be about 40% of the Russian federal budget next year. An additional 30% is expected to be spent on various national security and classified matters. Inflation is around 9%. Perhaps more telling, its main source of revenue are under severe pressure. Gazprom, the state-owned natural gas giant that in 2022 provided about $40 billion to Russia's state coffers, announced a $6.9 billion loss in 2023, its first in more than 20 years. Now is not the time to ease up the pressure on Russia. In a social media post after Assad's fall, President-elect Donald Trump said Russia was in a weakened state because of Ukraine and a bad economy, noting that 600,000 Russian soldiers lay wounded or dead in a war that should never have started. That is right. He also wrote that it was time for Putin to act, implying that the problem with getting a ceasefire or peace deal is Russia, not Ukraine. That is a refreshing shift from what had seemed in the past his tendency to blame Ukraine for getting invaded. In that post, Trump also said he knew that Vladimir well, that he surely knows a chief challenge will be getting Vladimir to abandon his dreams of reconstructing Russia's Tsarist Empire. Putin has pursued that vision since his first days in office, launching a savage war in Chechnya soon after coming to power, invading Georgia in 2008. Annexing Crimea in 2014 and attempting to conquer all of Ukraine in 2022. If Trump can convince Putin of that, he will be able to do what he has always said was his goal, end the war in Ukraine. Zakari writes for the Washington Post and is a host of CNN's Fareed Zakari GPS. Lilani Gomez writes a Tucson opinion, Tucson Poverty Project Exposes Need. Poverty and housing insecurity is a huge issue in Tucson. When talking with people of 29th Street Thrive Zone, I noticed patterns such as issues with drug usage and high crime. As well, I noticed people had stated that they could use help finding information or ways to find more help. I believe there are a few solutions that could potentially improve these issues and create even more opportunities for people. I believe this change can be very impactful and a step closer to fixing the issues. In Poverty by America by Matthew Desmond, it asks, what accounts for our lack of progress on poverty? Growing up in South Tucson, I have always noticed that the issue stated, and I think this change and issues have need to be addressed ages ago. Desmond brings up good arguments that money isn't being correctly allocated to help those in poverty and not being completely distributed. For years growing up, I had always heard the same question. When are they going to do something about it? When is the city of Tucson going to do something about all these issues? When is the city going to take care of its peoples? For this, I propose a few solutions or maybe steps to solutions that could potentially help the people of Tucson. In the city of Tucson, the crime rate was 5 times higher than the U.S. average in 2022, according to city data. More specifically, Southside Tucson and 29th Street account for these higher crime rates. I believe the neighborhood patrol car could be an open opportunity for more job opportunities, as well as more security and a sense of safety for the residents. Another issue I noticed was the need for more help searching for resources. Many people need the help to understand what resources are available to them and what they qualify for. It's always important to receive the help, understanding, and allocating resources available to you, which could go a long way for some. Evicted by Matthew Desmond shares a story of a single father who received a double check by mistake. In its Right and Responsibilities Guide, the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families informed clients who have been overpaid. You may have to repay benefits you received by mistake, regardless of whether it is your fault or the agency's fault. He then got deducted that double check, making him fall behind a month on rent. This issue can snowball and cause more financial problems for this person. This is an example of how a person in this situation may need the help of another person on how to correctly allocate their sources. I believe there should be a government building in the neighborhood for people to go and get these flyers with provided resources, as well as a financial advisor to help the people. In lecture, we discussed a book by C. Wright Mills, where he states, when a city's population of 100,000, only one man is unemployed, what is his personal trouble? For its relief, we properly look to the character of the man, his skills, and his immediate opportunities. But in a nation of 50 million employees, 15 million men are unemployed. That is a public issue, and we may not hope to find its solution within the range of opportunities open to any one individual. It is true that there is no solution to help everyone struggling with poverty, but there may be many small solutions that can help a handful of people, which leads to bigger solutions. I feel starting with the solutions stated may potentially help, and if not possible, perhaps create more solutions that could build up to the ones mentioned above. Examples could include having flyers listing available resources mailed to all residents, having free government access to financial advisors, or at least outlines of possible financial organization templates given to them in the mail. Every step to improvement, even a failed attempt, is still a step forward in a change for the better. I am a student at the University of Arizona participating in research on poverty in Southside Tucson, specifically 29th Street. This project is near and dear to me as I grew up on the South Side, having experienced very similar to the ones of the people I interview, and I believe change is long overdue. In sports, Arizona men's basketball, Lloyd to pull Stevens red shirt. Bracing for life without center Mohivas Crivas for the long haul, Arizona coach Tommy Lloyd is aiming to pull freshman Emmanuel Steven out of a redshirt season and mix him in to the rotation at some point. He just has to decide when to throw Steven into the fire, because there is a fire. Not only are the Wildcats just 4-5 heading into their final two non-conference games, their usual offensive flow is still broken. But their next opportune opponent thrives by disrupting offenses with a full-time pressure defense. In other words, Samford looks to throw teams out of whack in the way that the UCLA does, only with an even more chaotic style. So not only could the Bulldogs stress test the Wildcats' offense, but there could be a lot more for Steven to deal with in what could be his first college game. As a result, Lloyd said, he didn't have a master plan for when Steven would first check into the game. I'm trying to be mindful, Lloyd said. I know he's eager. I know he's got a lot of energy. But the last game, UCLA, and this game, Stanford, aren't necessarily warm-up games. I guess it's Samford, because we're in that new thing. I thought it was a mistake, but it probably isn't. Anyway, Samford aren't necessarily warm-up games for a freshman. I mean, you're playing against teams where there's pressure defense. There's substance to what they do. I want to make sure that he starts off, that he has maybe some good footing to get off to a good start. The Wildcats' talented but raw freshman, 7-footer Steven, could work his way eventually into a key backup role in the post alongside starting center Toby Awaka and power forwards Trey Townsend and Henry Vesar. Crivas was expected to be the Wildcats' top low post presence, a projected first-round pick whose return this season was thought to have eased U of A's loss of all-conference center Omar Ballo, but he's been limited by what appears to be a stress-related left foot injury since August. Crivas played pretty much nonstop in the offseason, standing out for Lithuania in the FIBA U20 Eurobasket tournament last July, but said he felt pain in his ankle after 2 weeks of workouts for Arizona after returning in late August. Crivas was cleared to open the regular season and played in the Wildcats' first game starting on November 22nd against Duke, but otherwise coming off the bench. Then he, otherwise coming off the bench, sorry. Then he experienced a setback before the Wildcats 57-54 loss to UCLA and did not play in that game. As weekly media gatherings Tuesday, Lloyd said he had no real update on Crivas, but acknowledged that the plan to return Stephen into Crivas could turn out for a while. Lloyd said after UA's loss to UCLA, missing the rest of the season was among the possibilities. Asked if Crivas could be stressing a stress-related injury that doesn't have a defined timeline, instead requiring continual monitoring, Lloyd nodded. Yeah, it could be, Lloyd said. Well said. So while UA's medical team monitors Crivas' health, Lloyd is the one monitoring everyone else. So far, that hasn't looked good either. Citing a number of different issues, including both mental and physical toughness, Lloyd expounded on that point Tuesday. When you're a team with a little bit of a fractured psyche, the belief probably isn't where you want it to be, and that's what we've got to fight for it, Lloyd said, referring to Arizona's loss to UCLA when the Wildcats 13-point lead melted away. They took the ball from us 15 times. Those turnovers weren't crazy passes. They just literally came and took the ball of our hands. They're ball hawks. I'll give them credit, but we've got to be tougher than that. You can say the scheme, the concepts, whatever, but the dude's got to hold on to the ball. That's their responsibility. They're accountable for that, and we didn't do a great job of it. Among other things, the Wildcats' offensive breakdowns resulted in shooting specialist Anthony Del Orso taking only one three-pointer against the Bruins in 14 minutes. Lloyd said the Bruins made it hard to string together three passes in a row, which obviously can make it tough on a catch-and-shoot guy waiting at the end of that string. But Del Orso said he still has to focus on making the right moves no matter what is going on, and said he believed the Wildcats learned from their ineffectiveness against the Bruins. Turnovers was the big thing. That's essentially how we lost, Del Orso said. But it's not things that we can't correct, not things we can't watch film and get better at. It's not a problem. You address it and you make adjustments in practice and then you get ready. Coincidentally, Samford is arriving just when the Wildcats are trying to figure out how to hold on to the ball. The Bulldogs were the last non-conference game Arizona scheduled, and potentially their toughest of the one-time guarantee opponents this season. That's hindsight, Lloyd said, of how the schedule turned out. I can't pull back after the UCLA game and say, no, we don't want to play, but we're good for it. We'll own it. Bring it on. Also, coincidentally, UA will precede the Samford game with a pregame ceremony in which former UA guard T.J. McConnell, the gritty Sean Miller-era point guard who helped lead the Wildcats to Elite Eight in 2014 and 2015, will be inducted into the UA's Ring of Honor. You know, our team needs a little T.J. McConnell right now, Lloyd said. They could use a little of his heart, his toughness, his grit, his will to win. We could use some of that. So maybe things are coming together for a reason. Arizona will play Samford, which has 9 wins and 2 losses, at 7 p.m. at McHale Center and on Wednesday today. You can watch the game on ESPN Plus or listen to it on 1290 AM or 107.5 FM. And again, that's tonight at 7 p.m. Pat Nugent, the head coach of the Mica Mountain High School football program, retired from his post, the school announced on Monday. Nugent steps down as head coach of the Thunderbolts following their undefeated season and run to the Class 4A championship in just the program's third season as a varsity program. We appreciate everything he's done for the Vail School District and his overall impact across Southern Arizona, Mica Mountain principal Nemer Hassey said in a release statement. He's one of the best coaches in Arizona. We appreciate him so much, and he will be missed. His contribution to our school district has been exceptional. After 27 seasons as a head coach at multiple levels, I've given up so much of my life and missed so many great moments with my family because I'm dedicated and put an awful lot of time in, Nugent told the Star on Tuesday. Ending his coaching career with a state championship is a dream come true, he added. You always want to keep fighting and battling, but to end up being a champion and 14-0 with a special group, it's a special way, Nugent said. It's always hard to leave, but it's a great opportunity to step away from the game. Pending approval from the Vail School District Governing Board, Micah Mountain, assistant principal and former longtime Sabino head coach Jay Campos is expected to take over the program. Campos went 133-35 at Sabino and led the Sabercats to four state championship appearances. In Arizona football, recruiting-wise, Arizona added another quarterback to its 2025 recruiting class on Monday when three-star Texas quarterback Sawyer Anderson committed to the Wildcats. The Dallas native was previously committed to the Purdue Boilermakers and was recruited by Graham Harrell's first-year Arizona offensive coordinator, Seth Doge's mentor, who was fired earlier this season. Anderson committed to Purdue since 2023. Doge is listed as the primary recruiter for Arizona on 247sports.com. Anderson committed to the UA over Purdue, Colorado, Miami, Mississippi State, North Carolina, TCU, SMU, Arizona State, Ole Miss, and Missouri, among others. The 5'11", 177-pound Anderson was a four-year starter at Parish Episcopal High School in Dallas and completed 859 of 1,320 passes, 65%. For 14,674 yards, 158 touchdowns, and 25 interceptions. The food section has a recipe for roast beef. And first, I'm going to give you the recipe for the roast beef seasoning rub, which yields about 1 cup. You use 1/4 cup coarse kosher salt, such as Diamond Crystal, 2 tablespoons red epaulette pepper, or sweet paprika, 1 tablespoon garlic powder, 1 teaspoon freshly ground black pepper or mixed peppercorns, and 1 teaspoon smoked paprika, which is optional. You mix all the ingredients in a small bowl or jar with a tight fitting. Use about half of the spice mixture for a 9-pound roast. This is the recipe for a slow-roasted beef rib roast with potatoes. It serves 8. The ingredients are about 1/4 cup roast beef seasoning rub from the recipe I just read, 3 bone prime rib roast, and about 9 pounds bones frenched, if desired, tied in a compact roast. So a 3-pound prime rib roast, which would weigh about 9 pounds, with the bones frenched, if desired, and tied into a compact roast. 3 tablespoons safflower oil or expeller-pressed canola oil. 24 small yellow potatoes, about 3 pounds, scrubbed and cleaned. Red wine au jus recipe, they've got that also, horseradish, and chopped red herbs such as parsley and chives for garnish. Make the seasoning rub. Rub the seasoning mixture all over the roast, on the ribs, and into the nooks and the crannies. Put the roast on a plate and cover loosely. Refrigerate for at least 2 hours or up to 2 days. Preheat the oven to 200 degrees. Meanwhile, turn on the exhaust fan. Heat a large cast iron skillet or griddle over medium heat until hot enough to make a drop of water sizzle on contact. Add a tablespoon of the oil. Then add roast flat down, cooking, turning the roast every 5 minutes until nicely browned on all sides. Then transfer the roast bone side down to a large shallow roasting pan. Arrange potatoes around the roast and drizzle the potatoes with the remaining 2 tablespoons of oil. Turn the potatoes to coat them with the oil. Put the roast with the potatoes into the 200-degree oven to on the median middle rack. Cook, rotating the pan occasionally until an insta-red thermometer inserted into the thickest portion of the meat away from the bone and the fat registers 120 degrees for rare, 125 degrees for medium rare, 4 to 5 hours. Begin checking the temperature after 4 hours. Keep in mind that the internal temperature of the meat will rise 5 to 10 degrees when it rests, so remove it from the oven a few degrees before it reaches the desired temperature. Make the red wine au jus and horseradish cream while the beef cooks. Transfer the roast bone side down to a cutting board and cover it loosely with foil. Let it rest 20 minutes. Meanwhile, increase the oven temperature to 400 degrees. Cut the potatoes in the roasting pan in half. Stir well to coat them with the pan driftings from the beef. Roast at 400 degrees Fahrenheit until golden about 15 minutes, then transfer to a serving bowl and sprinkle them with herbs. To carve the roast, remove the twine. Slice the meat down the bones into thin slices. Cut between the rib bones to separate them and arrange the beef slices and the rib bones on a warmed platter. Pass the red wine au jus and the horseradish cream for guests to add as they wish. Here's the recipe for the red wine au jus. 4 ounce diced beef scraps from the roast bone trimmings or beef chuck with fat. 1 tablespoon olive oil. 2 shallots or green onions, finely chopped. 2 cloves of garlic, finely chopped. Cloves. 1 cup of red dry wine or masala wine. 2 cups low-sodium beef or chicken broth. Salt and freshly ground black pepper to taste. Directions. Brown the beef scraps in oil or in a small saucepan over medium heat about 10 minutes. Stir in the shallots and cook 2 minutes. Then stir in the garlic and wine. Boil while scraping up brown bits from the pan until wine has reduced by half. Add the broth and simmer over the very low heat, stirring often, about 30 minutes. Strain. Taste and adjust the seasoning with salt and pepper. Serve hot. And they have horseradish cream with whole grain mustard and herbs. Use 1 cup sour cream or plain yogurt or a combination. 2 to 3 tablespoons of horseradish to taste. 1/4 teaspoon salt. 2 tablespoons whole grained mustard. And 1/4 cup fresh herbs such as chives, parsley, cilantro, or a combination. Mix everything in a small bowl. Refrigerate covered. 1 hour up to 2 days and serve at room temperature with the meat. Today, we will have abundant sunshine with a high of 81 degrees with winds from the east-southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, we'll have a clear sky with a low of 52 degrees Fahrenheit with winds at the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, again, it will be sunny with a high of 81 degrees Fahrenheit. So I hope that you enjoy your Christmas with your friends, your family, or even if you're home by yourself watching some good TV and eating some good food, especially this ribs roast sounds delicious. Take care and Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. Goodbye.